discussion, I think we do it by voice vote. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. Carried. All right, now we're gonna get into...
Now we come to a new crime in Oregon. At common law, the crime of solicitation did exist. However, Oregon, as we know, is not a common law crime state, and therefore, unless it's in the statutes of the present Oregon revised statutes, it's not a crime, and that is the situation. It's not defined as a crime in ORS. Oregon, like some other states that is in this situation, has abolished the common law crimes, accomplishes the reaching of the criminality of this kind of conduct in an artificial way, I believe, at least leaving out the adjectives. It does accomplish the reaching of solicitation through the law of attempt. And I cite the case of State versus Taylor, I believe, in the discussion here, where the person who wanted to burn down his neighbor's barn solicited another, actually two people, to set fire to that barn for him, and gave these two people some money to do it and some materials, and loaned them a horse to go set fire to the neighbor's barn. One of the two solicited turned, saw the light of religion and reported to the neighbors what was going on, and they lay in wait then at the barn to catch the other person who was actually going to do the setting in the act for purposes of getting a conviction for the attempted crime of attempted arson. Now obviously, we have the situation of the solicitation, that is the commanding of one by another to commit a specific crime, that is one that the person has in mind. The person commits the crime of solicitation if with the intent of causing another to engage in conduct constituting a crime. The way the court in State versus Taylor found the instigator of the crime guilty was to hold that he had done all he could by supplying the money and the materials and loaning the horse, and that constituted an attempt as distinguished from a preparation. This is criticized in the authorities and in the Model Penal Code as a strained interpretation of what really is a solicitation situation. That in most jurisdictions, the instigator there would not be guilty of the crime of attempt. He has not gone far enough himself, one of the reasons being that he doesn't have the intent of setting the fire himself. He does clearly, however, have the culpability requirements for the crime of solicitation. Now, we are recognizing that situation in Oregon by providing for the first time in the statutes, defining what that man did as a crime of solicitation and punishing it as may be determined in the sentencing provisions for a separate crime. Now, the case itself is interesting. I think we ought to look just at another aspect of it, because when the criminal conspirator in this case, the one who wasn't in on the tipping off of the neighbors, rode toward that barn with the materials to set the fire and got, I think, within actually 20 feet of it before he was scared off because he saw some wagons or some carriages that shouldn't have been parked there, and he was afraid that someone was watching. So he turned around and left. Now clearly he had, under most any test, had created or committed the crime of attempted arson. He'd gone far enough with all the materials. Now when the person in that situation commits the crime of attempt and has been commanded by another to commit the crime of attempt, the first one who commands is by complicity or accountability guilty of the crime of attempt through complicity rules rather than as Oregon strainedly found through the law of attempt.
What does actus reus mean?
And that's the harm that's defined, the actual act of the burning, for instance, is the social harm that's to be prevented. Or the killing in the case of murder.
Death, or so forth. Where I've heard that part of that was not really nice. There may be some misdemeanors you're going to prove, but I think this is go pretty far. Suppose Bruce and I are driving up the highway. Bruce says to me, look, I'm in a hurry.
You're the dude.
Who's driving?
All right, I'm in a hurry. We have a lot of misdemeanors with absolute liability, administrative crimes.
just wondered, I noticed you've got felony.
That's right. The subcommittee left this as a policy choice for the commission to decide. They couldn't decide. They decided to leave the decision as to whether it should apply to all crimes or to just felonies. Now, when you're considering the question, my original choice is to apply it the same way the Model Penal Code does, that is, a solicitation of any crime, whether it be a misdemeanor or a felony. Remember the kinds of misdemeanors that you have. The one you're suggesting is a very good one to keep in mind. Solicitation for reckless conduct is really what it is. Drive that car fast in a reckless manner, which may result in a very serious crime of manslaughter. Now, I think you ought to reach that kind of conduct through solicitation, although it never does go beyond the misdemeanor point of just simply reckless driving. I think that ought to be reached and punished on a lower level, obviously. It couldn't exceed, at least, the punishment for whatever the crime sought was, that is, the misdemeanor. It may be half, according to whatever the decision is.
The only thing is, I ask you on the other side of it, is that must be a misdemeanor crimes. I mean, it seems to me just simply because someone's asked you to do something, still there's a large realm of decision.
There's a fine line between that and being a principal. If it is a compass, now this wouldn't apply, but if the crime is a compass, because he'd be a principal.
That's right. Whether it ripens either into attempt or the completed crime.
Well, it ripens into a completed crime, yeah. Then this would...
Solicitation, according to Section 13, I believe it is, you could indict for both solicitation and the completed crime, but you convict for only one.
Yeah, so nobody would indict for solicitation, they would indict him for...
Yeah, probably
in most instances,
matter.
I would think. Well, because that has always been considered as right and proper, to make him a principal, if the crime is completed, it seems to me, by the same logic, it's right and proper to prosecute him for soliciting.
Are we going to make principals applicable to misdemeanors?
Oh, yeah.
They are now.
They are now.
Always have been.
This accessory
well,
is after the fact,
right,
that don't apply to misdemeanors.
Mr. Johnson moves we approve.
Again, it was a minority view in the subcommittee. And he really put two policy questions, as I recall, to the commission. The first was whether or not there should be a crime of solicitation, and secondly, if there was such a crime, should it apply to all crimes or just a felony. I think they're rather strongly that there should not be a crime of solicitation. And the reason for it is that, as a general rule, a crime is defined as a method of protecting society. And an uncompleted solicitation, nothing more than the example we use was a kid standing in the corner wearing a button that says smoke pot. Is that a solicitation? And even Frank agreed, I think, that it was awful close to it could be in the hands of an indiscriminate prosecutor, which we don't have any yet. But really, there is no great social harm done when the solicitation doesn't ripen into the attempt, and of course, they're not in the degree of crime. If they go far enough to actually make some move towards accomplishment, then they've got the attempt. And at that point, I say the crime should start. But simply to say, let you and I go knock off the bank, and nothing further. To me, this isn't a criminal conduct.
Well, let's use Lee's example. He tells me, we're going on a very hazardous stretch of road. Step on it, I want you to go 80 miles an hour or something. Now, I don't do it. I say, no, hell with you. But I get to next town, I stop in Frank's office, and I say, prosecute this guy, because he was soliciting me to drive recklessly.
Frank will say, drive on the Marion County.
Well, is this what we're talking about, George? That's this kind of thing?
Well, look at the other side of it, though. Suppose I...
Well, if you do, it's not
I
solicitation.
You, John, I'll pay you $1,000 if you'll knock off Bruce.
That's not a misdemeanor. Oh, well, that's part of our problem we're thinking about.
And that's the only evidence you've got on me.
Well, to just confound it a little further.
Can you be convicted on the uncorroborated,
it wouldn't be an accomplice. So you can use that.
Why don't you suppose you're thoroughly enamored of the girl standing next to you at the cocktail party and you say, why don't you and I go to bed?
Well, I think we've solved that problem as long as our sexual offenses chapter goes through the way it is, because those what's suggested there, being fornication or adultery, is no longer going to be a crime in Oregon, and I hope that remains the situation. But you are opposing a situation which has caused difficulty in other states, and the critics of solicitation say, well, and what is really an innocent remark or an innuendo perhaps would may be taken as solicitation to adultery, which of course in Oregon that would be a felony. So we wouldn't have a situation, but in some states it's evidently a misdemeanor.
Can you imagine an Oregon jury under today's moral code?
Well, let's get down to some more specifics. We, and I hate to stall us, we're making such good progress here, but we're talking about a very significant area here, and we spent a lot of time in subcommittee.
We should talk about it.
Ultimately, Frank and I outvoted Frost, but all of us had our problems. But take the one about let's burn all flags, or let's go down and stop the inductions today, or all of these First Amendment areas that are sensitive. You ought to realize the import of this language. I voted for the language in subcommittee, and we reserved the decision on whether it would apply only to felonies or to all crimes for the full commission. But let me say
the conduct, though, you are trying to get at, really, which is very dangerous conduct, is I go to John and say, look, I'll offer you $1,000 if you knock off Bruce. Now, do you let me continue this until...
So you find some guy who will make an attempt?
...the step of making the attempt.
For $1,000, you think you'd have to go any farther than Joel?
Actually, I thought I'd get a little cheap.
It's a lot of money.
$9.99.
Well, you're making a pretty big step at this point when you're making a crime out of something that ultimately doesn't even result in attempt. Only solicitation, attempt, crime, and maybe conspiracy in between. I really don't think it's the type of conduct that is so socially reprehensible that it requires a criminal sanction.
How do you answer the question Lee just raised, though? The guy who goes around with $1,000 and approaches Gernstead, and Gernstead says no, and he approaches Haas, and Haas says no, and he approaches...
Well, Haas says yes.
And then he finally gets down to me, and I say, okay, and then I shoot you, or attempt to shoot you.
At that point, then you've got a crime, I would say.
As I understand this whole section, though, what we're trying to do is to stop things before they get to give the state some means of stopping something before it gets to the point where it creates a danger to somebody.
In the mafia type of situation, this might be the only thing you'd ever nail.
Yeah,
that's right. Once you have a dog's a good control, let's stop it before it gets to the end. If you want to go back far enough, extend your logic to the beginning, you should have people, because the people cause the social problem.
Well, I think you're going to have an awful hard time.
It's way efficient interviewing the dogs.
Do away with people.
I won't call for a motion, but let's have a show of hands generally on whether or not we favor a solicitation statute. Then if a majority indicates that we favor it, then let's bring up the question of whether we'll have it for misdemeanor felony. So everybody that generally favors a solicitation statute.
I'll move the form of a motion. I'll move the late section 4.
All right. Representative Frost moves to delete section 4.
May I make a comment? Before you vote, may I make this comment? I have the impression, I don't know how the vote's going to go, but I have the impression that perhaps the first motion ought to be either to leave in or leave out the felony language.
All right.
And then if, for example, I'm somewhat inclined to think my vote would be different depending on whether it's in or out.
All right.
And I don't know.
Is that acceptable with you, Dave?
Sure.
We'll withdraw that previous motion. Does somebody then want to make a motion to limit solicitation to one class of crime? So to what class?
Felons.
We're moving to insert felony where it now says crime.
Right, right.
All right. Now, I think we know the argument in favor of felony. George, give us your argument again on his favor of having it. Well, is there, you gave it, so I guess...
Well, one more thing that you ought to keep in mind that hasn't been mentioned is that if you make a policy determination here to restrict solicitation to felonies, then you may be making a policy determination with respect to restricting conspiracies to felonies. I think that's a bad policy, too, but you ought to keep it in mind, and perhaps even restricting attempt to felonies.
Well, I'd like to...
You ought to ask yourself if you really want to be non-uniform now with respect to the inchoate crimes.
Well, here's my question, George. I'm not so sure that there maybe aren't some enumerated misdemeanors, that there might not be another ground, midway ground, even between the misdemeanors and felonies. And that's enumerated certain misdemeanors. I can certainly see this with the conspiracy.
What are offenses and violations? They are crimes.
A lot of things you don't know whether they're felonies or what the hell they are until the judge passes the sentence.
Well, for that you treat it as a felony.
Well, but you treat it.
I wonder if that's what we, those who vote to insert felony, have that in mind.
Well, sure. Suppose it's larceny in the store or any other felony misdemeanor option. You could still be guilty of solicitation. In that instance,
suppose the judge sentences it as a misdemeanor.
Well, but that isn't the effect of the language, because
the language would make that solicitation criminal.
You could solicit for any crime which is capable of being a felony. Is
what it would mean. Yeah.
I commit the crime of larceny in the store. I'm prosecuted for it, and I get a misdemeanor sentence. And so, therefore, I'm a misdemeanor. 3 months later, Frank issues an information charging you with solicitation under that. And we have, by statute, limited solicitation to felonies alone. Now, in the beginning, it was an indictable misdemeanor, but it turned out to be a misdemeanor. Therefore, Bruce, representing you, files a...
He'd be out of luck in light of our discussion here.
Yeah, and change it a little bit. Suppose they're both indicted at the same time, but the guy on the principal crime was sentenced first.
What are we thinking about the way the sentences? We had the same thing came up with several bills were introduced in the House this past time. We wound up with conspiracy. The guy who conspired to commit a crime wound up with a heavier penalty, the way that Metropolitan Multnomah County law enforcement officers were working on it, going primarily for bookkeeping and the bookmaking. So, really
well, that's so, the thing.
Yes. But yeah, what I'm worried about is that blows the whole thing right there, because we have, for instance, we have, it's now a crime to put car bodies on the sizes of vets for streams. Mom and Pop are sitting on the kerosene lantern, and they say, let's next spring put that car body. That's conspiracy to commit a crime, misdemeanor. Conspiracy, according to the bill that was introduced, would become a felony. Mom and Pop just committed a felony.
Well, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, yep, but what are we getting into? I concur.
How about conspiracy?
In other words, conspiracy will never be more than a misdemeanor, or same with
conspiracy will depend again on the action prior to, but the most serious act conspired to and the conduct. Might be several crimes conspired to at the same place of conduct.
If you want to be able to penalize solicitation, you look at the ultimate conduct solicited, and if that's capable of being a felony, then you want to allow the law to intervene to punish those who solicit felonies, even though it may later turn out that in that individual case, the judge said no, we'll turn it into a misdemeanor. I don't see any.
So long as it's understood.
The judge may have sentenced the guy in the shoplifting because he only stole the fountain pen, but the solicitor expected him to
steal the whole
bundle. Yeah.
Where Chairman, I'd move the previous question that we would ask on the fraud record. And Mr. Platts, each closed for 2 minutes so I can understand all this again.
All right. We'll let Dave close last because he's the moving party. Do you have anything further to add? The floor is yours. All right, then the question is on Representative Frost's motion to limit solicitation to felonies. Those in favor of the motion, say aye as you raise your call. Those opposed?
Green.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Junstead.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knight.
No.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Okay. All right. Sure, what's your wish?
I motion to delete.
Representative Frost means to delete.
Why don't we have a positive motion so we don't have to have another one then if we his fails, well, if you withdraw, we should approve that.
Mr. Johnson moves to amend the motion. What's your that we adopt it?
That we adopt it.
Chairman, the staff would like to be heard if you may before you proceed in time.
All right.
I could propose a middle ground.
I just find Harley the whole thing kind of concerns me too, and I'm thinking of what Dave's amended motion, or
well, I guess
the amended motion, yes. The thing that Lee pointed out, the offering of money to kill someone disturbed me, but as I read that situation, that would clearly fall in the attempt statute.
No.
Well, you got as evidence of attempt. You're at G, it's a soliciting an innocent agent to engage in conduct possible custody element.
Right.
The innocent agent there refers to one who has no idea that the person soliciting him wants him to commit a crime. Obviously, you would have an idea that you were being solicited to commit a crime if you were asked to kill someone. But where an agent is innocent, for instance, the example given, I think, might be where you want to burn your neighbor's barn, and you tell that innocent agent it's your barn and it's full of rats and you want to burn down, will you please go out and burn it for me tomorrow?
Harlow
does it. He's entirely innocent, but that's you're a principal in that case.
In Harlow's situation, wouldn't you wind up being an accomplice, and you'd need somebody else you need more evidence than you're going to have readily available? You have to have confession plus confession.
Wouldn't you feel offering $1,000 to kill someone would be a substantial step towards the crime? You wouldn't.
No, not more. I suppose you could. You could certainly easily find a factual situation or pattern to suggest that attempt exists, but I think without that, no, it wouldn't be an attempt.
Hasn't that been so held?
Yes, it's been so held rather consistently.
Okay.
Don wants to make a suggestion, and after we've done it all, move to amend. So then take a test of opinion on his suggestion.
Well, what I was thinking was this, that if you limit this to felonies, now you may well be excluding some misdemeanors that are going to be fairly serious offenses that you may want to treat the solicitation. Although they might be a step down, say, from our lowest grade of felony, there may be such a fine distinction between some of these crimes. I mean, look at some of our misdemeanors now. They're punishable a year in county jail and substantial fine. They're fairly serious crimes. Now, plus the fact that I think that we should leave ourselves a way to get to the indictable misdemeanor type of offense and make it clear that we're not limiting this to straight felonies. So I would suggest something along the lines that where we have the words constituting a felony, we could amend that to read constitute a crime punishable as a felony or as a blank, leaving that blank misdemeanor, giving us the opportunity when we grade our crimes to slug in, say, a Class A misdemeanor in there to get at the kind of crime that may not quite get up to the felony stage, but you might still want to try to prevent solicitation.
Well, you're saying that in recognition or in anticipation of the fact that we probably are going to reduce some crimes now to Class A misdemeanors that heretofore have been punished more severely.
Well, that's possible, certainly. That's
we won't know until we get
there. We won't know.
I agree with that.
I think it's...
Frank Knight has made Judge Burns' motion to amend as defined by Don Flint. If you understand that, I'll understand.
Oh, so everybody moved for it. Do we have to take a vote on it?
We just have a couple of sound now. We got the records down there.
What is the
motion is to engage in specific conduct punishable as a felony or
constituting a crime punishable as a felony or as a blank misdemeanor.
All right. Let's do it by roll call. Those in favor of the motion to amend, say aye as your name is called.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Jernstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Baldwin?
Aye.
All right. Representative Ross moves to delete Section 4. We'll do this by roll call. Those in favor, signify by saying aye as your first roll.
Judge Burns?
No.
Carson?
No.
Chandler?
No.
Frost?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Mary Jane called the block.
Jernstead?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
No.
Baldwin?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
Move the adoption as a bit more.
Johnson moves adoption of Section 4 as amended. I think I can only do it by voice vote. That those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Representatives Haas and Cross voting no. Let's take a 5 minute recess.
We've had some discussion with
that. Oh, sorry.
I think that now this will comply.
We really don't have that. Depends on the lunch hour, you know.
Well, the only thing I want to do is, no, not particularly, but I just don't want to start home at 6 o'clock at night.
No. Well,
I don't care about that.
I'll ask him when they come back, Bruce.
You can't get over the mountain before it gets dark this time of the year.
Are you driving?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Bob, I think we got an answer already on your question.
I don't know.
Two or three people suggested that we, in the interest of time, it might be a good idea to have some sandwiches brought in, go through the noon hour, and then try to get out about 2 or 2:30 if we possibly can. Is that agreeable?
Maybe we better set the car stop this week.
Yeah, right. I got a figure.
Does anybody have any preference with respect to this kind of sandwiches?
Nope.
No steak sandwiches for Jernstead.
Why not?
I mean, if we have a perfect one,
it would look perfect.
Okay, well, we'll leave it up to Roger's good judgment.
Don't get those old processed cheese.
The matter of discretion also, sure, we'd like to have Carson back in with you.
No.
It's not their voting record, but put me on the side when we've been very, very conservative.
Oh, we've instructed that next time I have to sit between Frost and Haas. Dirk says to sit between Frost and Carson. And then break this thing up pretty bad.
I noticed that they stepped Johnson and I on the other side of the table.
They can't talk to each other.
There's some psychology in there. I was glad to see you finally break up the triumphant thing.
Well, the real trouble was addressed.
getting further to the right there, Wally.
Well, that's one of my problems, too.
All right. We're on the section 5.
Yeah, this one is simply a renunciation of the defense for solicitation. I incorporate my previous remarks by reference. I would hope you incorporate your previous actions in the same way.
Is the same thing for solicitation as it was for attempt?
Yeah.
Chairman, I move the adoption of section 5.
You need to change the word crime in light of our amendment of...
Well, yes, that would be necessary, I think.
Well, there's nothing wrong with this, is there? And it would cover those misdemeanors that being covered in
short words.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we're automatic, wouldn't you? Could have to have a
non-existing
crime.
That's a prosecutor's.
Mr. Spolzer is absolutely correct. Is there any further discussion? If not, those in favor of the motion to approve section 5, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Pass. Now. Section 6.
Now we look at the third in the triumvirate here, and we call it crimes, conspiracy. The definition here is significantly different from the existing Oregon law in two respects. The present Oregon law pursues the bilateral nature of conspiracy that has existed for many years in most jurisdictions. That is to say, it speaks in terms of when two persons agree to commit a crime, this constitutes conspiracy with other elements. The first difference in the definition in this section is that when one person agrees with another, and that seems insignificant, but if you think about it for a moment, it isn't. When one actor agrees to rob a bank with another, and that other is an undercover police agent, barring any entrapment questions now, under that situation, the person who really wants to rob the bank and thinks that he's agreeing with another to rob the bank could not be held guilty of conspiracy under the present law in Oregon. Now, there aren't any cases to that point in Oregon, but cases construing that situation elsewhere pretty uniformly held that it takes two to make a conspiracy under that kind of language, where it says when two or more agree. Now, the Model Penal Code and most, I think without exception, of the new codes throughout the country turn away from this bilateral emphasis and put it on a unilateral emphasis so that the person agreeing to commit the crime, who in fact can commit the crime, does have the mens rea, can be reached under the conspiracy statute, even though the person with whom he conspires is a police agent, is insane and obviously incapable of consent, or is an infant, or for some other reason cannot consent to the course of conduct. The second major change, I believe, and one which you now, by your previous action, I think have changed back, in that respect, conspiracy would apply to misdemeanors and felonies. Existing law limits conspiracy to felonies only in Oregon. And I would assume you'd have resolved this point by now you'd want to have the same kind of provision as with respect to solicitation here, that is, apply it to indictable misdemeanors and certain class, high-grade misdemeanors. Those are the principal differences, then, in this basic definition of the crime of conspiracy.
Chairman, I move the appropriate amendment. What do you make the amendments?
Well, it's
instead of offense, it's felony or like we wrote in that other thing.
Right. All right. Well, let's just have a motion to approve the section, and if that passes,
with directions from the staff to turn into section 4.
Right. Is that your motion?
Yeah.
All right, you've heard the motion to approve section 6, the appropriate technical amendment. Is there any further discussion on it?
The only thing we talked about in section in this was the act of agreement. And I think it's not a contractual term. Doesn't require necessary
consideration.
No, like the capacity to agree is something about with the incompetent or the insane.
That's well established by authority, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so. Obviously, we can't have an objective test being applied, which applies, of course, in contract law. We're talking in terms of mens rea, which is subjectivity in criminal law.
Conscious parallels.
Okay, is there any other discussion? I think we'll do it on voice vote. Everyone in favor of the motion to approve, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Section 7.
See, I'm not sure. Let's see if we reach the point where we're suggesting a different course. No. All right. Section 7 defines both Section 7 and 8 reflect existing law, again, with the exception noted that Oregon has no conspiracy law in this area. Oregon has practically no law or case law on conspiracy except that dealing with evidentiary matters, the hearsay rule, where more than one person is engaging in criminal conduct, and that arises not out of a charge of conspiracy usually, not out of an indictment of conspiracy, but out of indictment for the complete offense, and then bringing in these long age-old hearsay evidence rule with respect to conspirators. Now, we're defining not in a new fashion, I don't think, or not in a fashion different from existing law, the scope of the conspiratorial relationship. It is a problem, however, to know how far the conspiracy extends beyond the immediate conspirators. If I agree with Lee to stick up a bank, and Lee then goes out without my knowledge and agrees with Dave that Dave will drive the car on this deal, Dave in turn goes out and yet finds someone else to supply the guns. This is all part of the conspiracy, certainly. It's all part of the bank robbery. Question is, now, we're focusing in a unilateral sense on my culpability, not yours at this point, on mine. What did I intend? What was my purpose? What was my agreement with respect to the course of criminal conduct? This defines it so that there is a limit, ultimately, on how far, on how many conspirators in the chain can be brought in and tried, presumably at the same time, and even more important, how many of their statements made out of court, how many of their admissions may be used under the hearsay evidence rule against me, and that's an exception in the criminal cases. The section says, in briefly, that if I know, if I know that the person with whom I conspire, Lee, is going to conspire with someone else, although I don't know who that is, then I'm a conspirator with that someone else. Now, in the situation that I've mentioned, I think clearly I would be conspiring with all people in the chain, because it takes a car to rob a bank and it takes the guns to rob the bank. And I would anticipate that Lee, my fellow conspirator, would go out and conspire as necessary to supply these various materials. Now, somewhere along that point, if you get on and on beyond, where maybe a conspirator, the fifth one down the line, says, well, now look, on the way to the bank, there's this supermarket. Why don't we just get our money's worth out of these car and guns by going in here and sticking up the supermarket? Now, the question becomes closer, whether I meant to conspire with Lee to rob that supermarket. And it becomes a jury question within the language of this section. If I, in fact, knew that this is liable to happen, then I would be a conspirator with respect to anything that might flow from it. But I think you can see the desirability of fairness with respect to one defendant of not imposing on him the chain reaction of a conspiracy that may be far beyond anything that he reasonably could expect or subjectively expected.
I might mention, George, a recent case in Multnomah County, a series of cases actually, which I think somewhat illustrate this point here. Talking about here, these are the cases dealing with the conspiracy to defraud the insurance companies by burning down a
warehouse
and other structures. And the central guy in it was a guy named Smith, who's up the street here. And there he conspired with A, to burn down the warehouse, and with B, who was the adjuster, to make the phony, get the payment from the insurance company. So they alleged a conspiracy of A, B, and C, C being the mastermind, and A lighting the match, and B issuing the draft. Then, separately, when they got into it and investigated, they found out not only had this been true of the warehouse, it had been true of about a dozen houses around town, and usually, in each instance, there were different guys involved. In other words, the guy that burned down the warehouse, for example, didn't burn down any of the houses, although maybe there was some suggestion he may have burned one of them down, but he didn't know anything about all the rest of them. And in that instance, they did indict separately. They made each structure a separate indictment. It had the Smith, the mastermind, in it, and then the adjuster and the fire setter in each instance. I think that probably illustrates also. They didn't attempt to show that the guy that burned down the house in Laurelhurst had conspired with the guy who burned down the warehouse.
Well, that's
the main purpose of this, isn't it, is to make that statement so a lot of other guys are miserable against the big shot.
Yeah, that's the Louisiana.
Yeah.
Plus the wheel kind of conspiracy versus the chain. I gave a situation where it's a chain, and probably everybody in the chain, at least the bank robbery part, would be guilty of the conspiracy. But the case that the judge is talking about, and in fact the case that the United States Supreme Court has considered, it's Kodiakus versus the United States, is the wheel of the hub dealing individually with people out here. What he was agreeing was to fraudulently make applications with FHA or something to get loans for these people out here. I don't know whether it's an insurance deal or not. But none of these people out here knew about the existence of each other. And it was held that they couldn't be treated as part of the conspiracy with each other. They could only be treated as conspiring with the hub of the wheel. And I think properly so. And this draft reflects that policy.
Well, but under Section 8, the hub would be only involved in one conspiracy, not multiple.
That's right. Section 8 says, and it reflects current law, that where you engage in a conspiracy to commit a number of crimes, or the same crime a number of different ways or with different people, passing 10 bad checks, in other words, each passage is a crime, but if you're conspiring to engage in the passage of checks, then you can be only indicted for the one conspiracy, not for a conspiracy each time.
Well, but now, what would the prosecution do in your hub case here where there's a burning of, you know, six houses or six buildings with six different people? The center three, the hub three, if you tried to get number one up there, you might charge him with the center three, but then when you came to two, you couldn't charge him with the...
You have to have another case like they did in Portland. That's why they had a lot of cases.
No, but the center three are going to be home free because...
Well, I think under George's language, the case I mentioned, I don't think they could have indicted Smith for more than one conspiracy count. They could indict him for a number of arson counts. Wouldn't prevent that.
He only had one conspiracy.
That's
right.
Involved
more than one thing.
Yeah.
But the big problem is, I don't know, what is the famous New York case on this? I think it was Louisiana.
Yes.
The center of the hub. I can't remember the exact facts. But
well,
I think
you could the girls of the night on the outside.
Yeah, but I think you could get the case where the girls of the night and everybody else knows what goes on in the they know vaguely that the organization is engaged in a lot of illicit activities. But do you really hold the little prostitute?
No.
Guilty of a conspiracy.
Not to look at you look at her intent within the basic definition of conspiracy. What she proposed to engage in, and she certainly doesn't propose to engage in the placing of 50 or 100 other girls in houses of prostitution or the payment of the police or whatever Luciano was doing himself. All she's engaging in is agreeing to submit herself to this lucrative endeavor.
George, in Section 7, does this really say what you say it said?
Does it say what you say?
Yeah. Where you say that a person knows that a person with whom he conspires to commit a crime has conspired with another person or persons. It doesn't make any difference whether he knows who they are.
No, he doesn't have to know their name.
But now, in your situation, where you and Lee first talk about your armed robbery, and then he goes out and conspires with a couple, three of the rest of us, would you really be involved in their conspiracy from the day of their
statement?
Has conspired, or he knows that he will conspire with others.
Yeah. I don't want to certainly make a past tense problem again. We've got one here. Because it is conspiracy continues, continuing course of conduct, and
has conspired or will conspire.
Eliminate that ambiguity.
Has conspired or will conspire. I do that again.
Question. Motion is to pass Section 7.
Right? No. The motion is to amend Section 7.
Nice try, John.
has or will conspire.
I thought I could
cover a later extension.
All right. Since you're all such a special wise guy. Everybody that's in favor of the motion, signify
that.
You had to change the tent.
Yeah.
To signify their approval by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. No.
Move the adoption of section.
Motion is passed.
Question.
Motion is to approve Section 7 as amended. That those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Carried. Section 8. No.
Under Section 8, if three guys agree with each other to go into the bank and rob the business, rob every bank in Oregon one a month, and get whatever help they might need during this. Time to take to do that. Is that only one crime?
This problem came up.
Yes, that's only one crime. And then it goes back here. There is a little provision that says that if he's been convicted or acquitted once of one conspiracy, in Section 3, he cannot be tried again. So in other words, if...
better pick your best bank robber.
Well, you pick your best bank robbery, or the thing that I raised, but we really couldn't, George and I couldn't find any language to take care of it. Suppose there is this big organized crime conspiracy that we have. You're tried, and the judge, because you're a nice old man, sent you a couple years, and you get out in 12 months, and you're back right into the business.
So you finish up that job that you'd already been you're talking about doing, you can't be
so, but you're still involved, you're still sitting up there in the head office in Portland running the syndicate, and so we try to charge you again, and no, you've been, this is all part of this continuous conspiratorial relationship, and when I didn't repent when I went to the penitentiary, I intend to continue, and they consulted me from time to time, and I passed out word, I'm still part of this conspiratorial relationship, and you cannot try me again.
Bruce gets
shot. Well, couldn't they,
You see, that's what bothers me about this.
They can convict a guy of conspiracy to commit a crime and convict him also of committing that same crime.
Yeah, if he goes so far as to be a principal. I mean, if you could get him into the accomplice of the principal situation. I mean, this is what they say. Okay, but you sit up there in the head office, you make sure you don't get into that principal situation anymore. You're the owl. You're not the rabbit that has to...
Well, I think we got that owl.
Okay, George.
This is a beautiful example of the difference between law and theory, which you're really talking about, and law and practice. My gut reaction to your problem was, and it never happened, you'd never sell any jury that somebody agreed to rob every bank in Oregon at the outset. The jury just is going to say, no, you're not going to come in here and pull that stuff, and our judge would feel it. And I think that's evidently the way the courts have reacted. I cite you to an article in 57 Columbia Law Review, 387, and this is the statement now. When determining whether one or more conspiracies exist, the focus of the court's attention is the agreement. Now that seems to say what you say, and not the multiplicity of the acts done in pursuance of it. However, and this is the interesting part, I think, when it is to the defendant's advantage to claim that he has participated in only one conspiracy, despite the existence of a number of conspiratorial objectives, the courts have frequently shifted the focus of examination away from the agreement and toward the activities performed by the group, which means they're going to disregard the technical or theoretical language and look at actually what's going on in order to reach the conspirator.
Okay, the courts have, but does our statute do that? No,
I think so.
Our
I think
statute
it'd be construed that way because this,
from doing it
this statute reflects what existing law is. It isn't a change at all.
Well, the problem is when you have a bunch of case law and you try to put it down into a statute, first you can't limit it.
It wouldn't hurt a bit, George, to expand the commentary to reflect that what you just read. It would be helpful. Furthermore, it might get a vote from Frank Knight.
My vote usually doesn't make it.
I certainly see Frank's concern. We don't want to have the really intelligent criminal, and many of these fellows in organized crime are pretty smart, and you've got a bunch of smart people working for them. Looking ahead, planning ahead, as it were, to take care of any exigency. I just don't think it's going to happen. Nor do I think the courts are going to construe it.
Continuous conspiratorial relationship, and we may not. I mean, that first meeting may just encompass narcotics, and then we bring in prostitution, bookmaking, and all that type of thing. But it certainly is one continuous conspiratorial relationship. I mean, we have our weekly meetings and report back to.
Now, if Bruce's in prison for this 12 months, though, can he maintain a conspiratorial relationship during that 12 months, or would that be broken?
Theoretically, but not practically. I mean, this is the point I have.
Could he plead this?
I mean, he didn't come back.
Yeah, but the question is the continuous, and
Bruce
sure
he's going to
be was broken. That's what he's going to do.
Well, yeah, but there's ways of doing business from prison. That's great.
Sure.
The jury agrees with the court. Well, this is going to be a double jeopardy.
Yeah. Frank, now, the sanction's limited. It says he's guilty of only one conspiracy. It doesn't say he's guilty of only one crime. And I think we've got to keep in mind the distinction between the conspiracy to commit a crime and the completed substantive offense itself. And if you're going to get him under as an accomplice, aren't you?
Well, not when he's sitting up there
not
in
that
high
office
building.
Well.
The only way you're going to get to him most of the time is going to be on a conspiracy basis. He's never going to get close enough to the actual.
Well, that's a more we've defined an accomplice under our party's draft. He's guilty, he's criminally liable for the conduct of another person constituting a crime if with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the crime, he A, solicits or commands such other person to commit the crime, or aids or abets or agrees or attempts to aid or abet such person in planning or committing the crime. And then the other ones with legal duty to prevent. But those two, it would seem to me, would get to that kind of individual, wouldn't it?
Except, of course, then I would think it would be easier to persuade the jury by far that the two guys conspired to do something. That,
what's the reason for this section?
I don't think it's.
Well, the reason for the section is to prevent accumulation of punishment in an unfair manner. The example would be where a couple of moonshiners are indicted for violation of the same statute on 10 different occasions, and the judge sentences them 2 years for each one, or 20 years.
But isn't that a matter of sentencing?
Well, we don't want to give the judge the opportunity, not that he'd take it, but we don't want to limit it.
You think we've got a bunch of hot sitting on the circuit bench, right?
What they're really concerned about is the state charging him multiple times. I mean, like, what they want to do is set out a moratorium that you can write checks all 1 week for one crime. If you start the next week, that's another crime. Well, but this is part of it that they don't want him. George, you had some other. You started to read some other.
Well, involved here is the same evidence rule in the double jeopardy situation. And there's some interesting. The statement I'm reading is supportable by cases that incite those, obviously. The general rule with respect to the same evidence is that indictments relate to the same offense when the evidence necessary to support the latter would have sustained a conviction under the former indictment. All right, that's double jeopardy. But in conspiracy, courts have found no former jeopardy where a mere change in the co-conspirator is alleged. Now, that's an exception to the same evidence rule, and it's criticized, and yet it's found to be the law that's generally applied. So, to get your general wonderful conspirator who goes to jail once for that conspiracy and gets out and then on another indictment claims double jeopardy, and the courts have held elsewhere that just simply by changing the indictment to include another conspirator, it certainly wouldn't be hard for the prosecutor's office to put in another name, if the same evidence can be used again, the conviction can be had for a conspiracy.
Right, so that when we get back to that hub and wheel thing, you can have with your three guys in the hub, you can indict them for each conspiracy with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So they could be charged in 6 indictments with conspiracy. So if what you're saying is true and is the law, then Section 8 doesn't mean a dang thing and we don't need it. It's just going to confuse the issue. By pointing to the statute and saying this is the law, but pointing out the cases, no, it doesn't mean what it says at all. And so it shouldn't be there. I move we delete Section 8.
Well, I think we should bear in mind as we're discussing this subject. In Section 13, it is presently proposed to forbid the prosecution of the substantive offense
of conspiracy.
And conspiracy, where
it says the prosecution
may not be convicted on the basis of the same course of conduct of both the actual commission of the offense and conspiracy to commit that offense. Now, with that, if we stick with Section 13, I'm inclined to think Frank's got a pretty good point here.
But Section 13 isn't the law now.
No, it is not.
Is this the thing?
No, it isn't.
Can you answer his contention that it doesn't mean anything, George?
Well, I'll answer it this way. It's kind of a cop-out. It wouldn't break my heart if Section 8 didn't appear, because I think the results are what Section 8 said, whether or not we have a statute on it.
We don't presently have any.
Question.
All right. Question's been asked for.
I'm just not sure I'm satisfied that the striking it does all the job either.
If what?
Striking this section up does all the job. Right? I'm not sure we fully examined this question.
Do you want me to refer to the committee
one? This has been a continuing conspiracy.
We have, Frank and I consulted by telephone and personally a couple of times about drafting language to lay the fears that he's raised. And I'm of the opinion that it is virtually impossible, if anything is impossible, to cover the situations by statutory language that he suggests. That I think this is the only answer is the way courts are going to react and the way the cases are going to be decided. If you send it back to the subcommittee, that would be my advice to the subcommittee. They could certainly tell me to do something else, obviously, but I don't think you can draft your way.
No, we're not going to send it back.
Anyway, beyond
that. I think the press can probably handle it better on individual cases than they can if we try to tell them how to handle all cases.
He's going to be in this general area here for what George said.
Question. We'll do it on roll call. Those in favor of the motion strike, say aye. Those opposed, no.
Yeah.
We're going to delete 8 in its entirety. That's the motion.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark? Frost?
No.
Foss?
Aye.
Jernsted?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
All right. After 2 days, Frank Knight has scored.
I gotta get my cat out.
Get a pressure
call
home.
Don't. No. Call home.
Yeah.
Call a station.
All right.
Get that thing.
Section 9.
Does this belong here?
I suggested already to Don that we at least hold this until the very end of the article for consideration. It isn't part of the logical flow of what we're talking about here. It's largely procedural. And in the interest of perhaps saving time and not breaking the chain of the substantive examination of crime, I would at least hold it over until we finish section 13.
Okay, out of objection, we'll go to 10.
You might want it broken.
We'll go to 10.
The renunciation problem is the same, unless you want to make a distinction in renouncing the crime of conspiracy, I would assume that you would adopt this section.
Will be approved, section 10.
Second.
All right.
Of course, you got a guy that's been a member of the mafia.
What does manifesting mean? Does that mean under circumstances suggesting?
It means to make manifest.
To make sure?
Now, when it was manifest, he was about to be exposed.
Well, I mean, does that mean that it's certain that he does that? It doesn't mean just
that. Not to get that he claims it.
Well, manifest tends to suggest, doesn't it? Or tends to prove.
Would showing be clearer in your? I certainly would accept any kind of word.
Well,
sure.
Maybe this word means it. That's why I said.
You've already approved it twice.
Manifesting.
Yeah, it's a little bit different.
3 and 5. Renunciation of attempt and renunciation of solicitation. Say the same thing.
Yeah, it does. I didn't know about it.
Shot down. Maybe not. We spent 4 hours on manifestly won some one of the time.
Where's the dictionary? What the hell is the name?
She just wants to get it.
Oh. Yes.
Of course.
Under this leave where you say the guy, the member of the mafia, well, he's got to.
Manifest destiny.
That's 54, 40, or 5.
To make clear or evident, show plainly, reveal, or evince.
That's a reasonable
definition of it.
Yeah, I think it's all right.
Is there any other discussion?
Question's
been asked for. Motion is to approve section 10 without amendment. We'll do it by voice vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. Dave? Aye. Section 11.
Now this is dealing with certain defenses which are now clearly stated to not be available to a defendant. Subsection A could be demonstrated, I suppose, by the situation where one conspires to suborn a juryman and agrees with that person who he thinks is the juryman, that the juryman will vote in a certain fashion, when in fact that person isn't a member of the jury. The fact that that person is not a member of the jury, in short, sort of an impossibility defense again, would not be available to the indictment for solicitation, subornation, or conspiracy, or of subornation of that person, because that person simply doesn't occupy a particular position or have a particular characteristic that the actor thought he had. The second one relates, we've talked about this one, now we're making it specific. If you agree with one who's insane, or one who's underage, or one who is a secret police agent, this is not a defense to the crime of conspiracy on the grounds that you alone conspired, therefore it can't be conspiracy because it takes two to conspire. That is not a defense, especially in light of our new lateral emphasis on conspiracy. The third, sub C, reflects what is existing law. I think that so far, all of these reflect existing case law elsewhere, no case law in Oregon. Where one has been prosecuted for or convicted, that is where the co-conspirator has already been prosecuted for or convicted or is immune from prosecution for some reason. This is no defense. Again, this is going back to assert that the bilateral concept of conspiracy is no longer followed. It's the unilateral agreement on the part of the actor who's now being prosecuted. And perhaps one that goes beyond existing law, but there is some support for it, and that is where one of the conspirators has actually been acquitted of the conspiracy. The conspirator tried second later cannot assert that acquittal as his defense because of the simple fact that justice goes awry from one trial to the next, and there's no reason to automatically allow him a defense on that basis. Now, let's see.
George, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Where are you?
You can answer me a question, but I didn't say anything about answering.
You're on the wrong page.
1 of 11?
He's on 12.
Did I skip a second?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I wonder
if I was having some damage.
I apologize.
So really, George, you should go back and start all over again, because until
I wasn't listening to
it. Well,
okay.
I couldn't understand what
you
were saying.
Were on 12.
It didn't make any sense to me.
You were on 12.
I was on 12.
And I was falling left. Why don't we take a 5-minute recess while we eat? And
I'll go back to the gym.
I was reading 11.
No, I was having a hell of a time.
I was good.
Okay.
I just closed it out.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I've got a problem here with one more.
Still be continuing.
Well, George gave us this 12 talk, so we really should have the opportunity to give us this section 11 talk.
When the crime is terminated, when the crime is committed, may include the cutting up of the loop as part of the crime.
Well, it may not, too.
It does in Oregon, by case law. And the crime would not be terminated under this definition until the loop had been separated. I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but there, in other words, the general language here would incorporate whatever the court may decide with respect to what are acts flowing from the crime, not just the sticking the gun in the face of the clerk in the liquor store, but perhaps taking his safe out of the store when they leave and going to an apartment and several hours later opening that safe and splitting up the proceeds. And I think we have a case that I'm referring to that exactly happened. And for purposes of admitting statements made during the time of sticking the gun in his face and the actual opening up of the safe and passing out the crime, and those statements were held to be admissible because the crime was not complete that had been conspired to.
Suppose you have a group of guys who, pull a number of bank robbers. They've completed their fifth robbery. They've provided up the loop. They periodically meet. just discussed generally, they might commit another bank robbery.
Latest development in the bank robbery.
They haven't decided to commit one. Just discussed generally. It seems to me the crime of conspiracy is, and the whole theory of the crime of conspiracy is the agreement.
Well, that's a new conspiracy then. It would be a new conspiracy.
No, but there's no specific bank in the period. This isn't the pre-conspiracy negotiation period.
Well, true. We're talking about one guy here now, one man, in this continuing course of conduct, who reaches the point, short of getting religion and blowing the whistle on the whole operation and stopping the bank robberies by having his cohorts arrested. Instead, he says to his friends, cut me out. Deal me out of this deal. I don't want to rob any more banks.
I agree with the abandonment. I don't have any problem with that. I'm talking about the first part of the sentence, which is termination of crime or crimes which are its objects are committed. And I'm just not certain. That's always the point of termination.
Could you use the term completed, and then the disposal of the goods and this type of thing would be part of the...
Yes, it
the
would.
Completion thing of it.
Yeah,
but it wouldn't be the actual act would have been committed.
Sure. If part of the conspiracy was for Bruce, Bob, and I to rob the bank and divide it three ways, we robbed it on the first month and we went back on the 30th and got the money out of his from his hiding place and divided it, at that point we would have completed the conspiratorial conduct.
But Lee's later point then was that the 31st of the following month, we meet again, not with the idea of sticking up the First National Bank of Corvallis, but just to discuss bank robbery in general and whether or not we should buy some mace to use if we ever decide to rob another bank.
That's a new conspiracy if they do anything.
But if they just stop it right there.
Okay.
Watch, well, if those two guys, though, went on and split the money up, you didn't get in on it. Would you be guilty of conspiracy in the first case? If it wasn't completed, you didn't get your third?
Yeah, because the crime was the robbing of the bank, not the splitting of the money.
Conspiracy is the
crime. But we got to remember what we're talking about here is the statute of limitations, when the statute of limitations is going to start to run on you, at what time.
Well, simple thing to do on this is just to make the statute of limitations last.
That's fine.
And you're wrong.
I don't know how to get into one of the special statutes of limitations.
Well, the reason I'm a little concerned about this is that if any trustees with statute of limitations are not going to be very important. Well, your antitrust cases aren't going to be affected by this. Oh, I think they will, from the standpoint of concerned to be under a civil statute of limitation, which is the point of the conspiracy ends of the criminal statute. I'm talking about if we have an Oregon statute.
Well,
we have a good reading statute.
I would move to amend paragraph 1 there. It says terminates when the crime or crimes which are its object are committed, delete committed, put in complete.
I'm not sure that adds.
I mean, it does.
Okay.
But it doesn't really add very long. I mean, in the bank robbery case, why, none of the three of us is going to trust the others enough to let them keep the money and put it out in time deposits for a year. So let's put it up. So you're talking about a 3 or 4 day period.
You can look at an extortion case or a ransom case, kidnapping, and there might be a period of time between the kidnapping of the child and the delivery of the money and splitting up the money. And it seems to me that this clarifies it. You've heard the motion, substitute the word completed for committed on line 3 of sub 1. Section 11. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. All right. Any other discussion about Section 11?
I think part of the discussion should, we should at least talk about this. According to minutes, when this was when we passed this section, it says we suggested passing section 11 along with the commission and raising before the commission a question of whether it should be in this section or in the previous section. We talked about that at the time, and there's discussion back and forth as to whether this property belonged in the Unitoid Crime section or whether it should be in the.
Well, it in part defines the crime, how long it goes.
Well, I.
It's an absolutely a different kind of fish, I think. The conspiracy makes the problems with the statute of limitations so different that it ought to be treated separately in the Unitoid Crimes article. Because of the continuing nature of the crime.
Did you have a thought here about the end of the
No, road? I wanted to bring it up. I'd forgotten we'd done that. I do have a question on, are we down to sub 3?
Yeah.
I have a question on sub 3. If an individual seeks to take advantage of this, and says, well, the statute is run on me because more than 3 years before the indictment was returned, I told those birds that I wanted no more of this people. And
indictment for what?
What?
Indictment for what? Conspiracy?
Conspiracy, yeah. To rob banks in order. And let's say it's a continuing kind of a deal. And it went on over a number of years. But as far as I was concerned, I was in on the first couple of go-rounds. But not on the, from there on I told him I want no more of this. And that's the only evidence. Now, is he completely off the hook?
For the conspiracy, yes. But not for the completed subsequent crime.
Is that true under...
See, he hasn't frustrated the conspiracy with respect to those future crimes of which he now tries to disassociate himself. The only way he can have a complete defense, I would think, would be to frustrate the completion of any more crimes.
Either if the defendant says all our uniforms for law enforcement authorities, should that be in?
No. No, because he doesn't have to frustrate the completion of the criminal goals here. He may very well frustrate them by telling the police. But if he tells the police, I'm out of this deal, I'm abandoning, and the police do nothing, he certainly has no renunciation as a complete defense. But he has inserted, he has started the statute of limitations running with respect to the abandonment.
Yeah, I get it. That's the point we're talking about, the statute.
Now, I had a question. How does this work? How would sub 3, how would this be injected by a defendant, or how would the issue be raised so far as statute limitations?
The state has to prove that the crime was committed within the statute of limitations. And if the state would have to look at that 2-year statute that in December of 1964, there was this big meeting and they were going to hit banks periodically and big plans for hitting the banks, and then show that the banks were continuing to hit. Here it is now, 1969. Probably by showing that the meeting in 64 and the continuing part of the conspiracy going on, the banks being hit, this probably would be sufficient to get them by the statute of limitations question and proving that the crime was committed in the last 3 years. Particularly if they could show any type of association with the guy who's still living in the same community with the rest of the guys. That then would be up to him. Once he came in, that guy knows I was in on the first 3 jobs in early 65, which is after the cases are now run on, so I can sit up here and tell you all about it.
But after that, when we had the meeting here in January or February of 65, I told him I didn't want to deny it anymore. I wasn't going to have any part of it. Bank robber, the state was going to be, well, I'm going to have something to show through the association.
And as evidence of association, so on, it'd be a jury question, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Frank. See, there's nothing, this isn't plain in terms of the defense. Mm-hmm. It's set through.
Right.
So, I don't think you want it in terms of
the defense.
Right.
It would just be a matter of if the state has some evidence which refutes that, his unilateral testimony was abandoned more than 3 years ago. It goes to the jury, and the court is instructing the lawyer to substitute and instructing on the statute of limitations.
Of course, he could bring in his four buddies and sure that they would catch that.
Yes, maybe so.
In February, he told us he was going to get out and get rid
of it. But if in fact he did get out of the conspiracy in 65, and he's going to be around in 70 or 69, I told him he'd be off the road.
They would if they were already.
What sense do you mean it has to be
existing in the statute?
That has been the subject of a case decision, I believe, in the United States Supreme Court. The Grunewald case. And the court held that you cannot presume, this prosecution cannot proceed on the assumption that they agreed to conceal the existence of this conspiracy for years and years after, in order to keep the conspiracy open.
Yeah, well, they do apply it to the civil,
but they said there, in the fact that you can't extend the statute just by alleging that one of the subsidiary conspiracies was concealed.
In
further detection and apprehension.
Now, what are your wishes?
Move it out.
As
amended.
There's a motion then that they adopted as amended. To do it by voice call, and then we can say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Come on, baby.
I've already covered section
12.
Good, that's the thing on the ground.
We're all even
ahead. Listen, section 11 provides. Section 12 is forestalling some defenses that have been raised in the past and which some courts have approved, but the majority ruling on them have disapproved. So we are reflecting and stating in a sense then the majority view in these subparagraphs with the exception which I'll note subsequently. When the defendant in a conspiracy or a solicitation case raises the defense that, well, the fellow that I conspired with to bribe wasn't a public official, therefore you cannot accuse me of conspiring to bribe a public official. This is not a defense to him anymore because it says that if he believes he was a public official, this is the old impossibility idea, if he believes that he was a public official when he conspired with or solicited the man to accept the bribe, that is not a defense because he unilaterally had the culpability of soliciting the crime or on his own part had the culpability of conspiracy to commit the crime. Now, secondly, and we touched on this one a little earlier, when a person solicits or conspires with one who is either insane and therefore incapable of agreeing to do anything, not responsible, or one who is a child, or one who is a police agent, who obviously does not have the mens rea of conspiracy, it's no defense to the actor or the proposer who has the culpability to commit the crime to say, well, I couldn't do it, it takes two to agree to the conspiracy. This is not a defense because of the unilateral nature and the way we're defining the crime. He himself is going to be held for the conspiracy or the solicitation.
The third subsection C, reflects existing law, that is, where one has not been prosecuted yet, where a co-conspirator hasn't been prosecuted. Sometimes the defense is raised, well, you haven't convicted him, how can you convict me? If you're not going to prosecute him, you can't prosecute me. This is not a defense in the established law. Going on with the explanation, I'll stop at any time. The explanation of sub C provides that, or if his co-conspirator has already been acquitted of the conspiracy, as I said before, this ought not to be the basis of determining whether the co-conspirator now on trial should have the, should be excused because his co-conspirator was acquitted previously in another court at another time. The rationale being that justice sometimes miscarries, the quantum of proof varies, the evidence, the weight of the evidence is seen in the eyes of the jury may vary, so the co-conspirator ought not to have that defense of the acquittal of the conspirator. The law is pretty well split on that one, so we might say we're making a change, or at least we can't say that there's a law one way or the other with respect to the weight of the law.
George, if I can interrupt you, this sub C, well, in fact, this whole section is consistent with the action of the commission of parties to crime, party hold with respect to liability and the conduct of the
matter. George, the only thing that bothers me is that under 2, are you implying that an accomplice can be guilty of a conspiracy?
Well, in the normal case, yes. Accomplices can be guilty of conspiracy, with the exception of a Luciano type of conspiracy, where complicity and conspiracy do not necessarily follow. It's possible, in other words, to, because some cases say that because there's a conspiracy, there is automatically complicity. And this is not so, at least in the ideas of this graph, and on the pattern of a Luciano type case.
And you can see that a person is a party to a conspiracy, but he's got a principal, isn't he?
In an extreme fact situation where you've got a long and huge kind of complex conspiracy going on, it would be pretty rare. Now, Section 2 is again consistent with the complicity section, I believe. This governs the situation of statutory rape, for instance. You can't hold the girl for conspiring to commit statutory rape because she can't be held for the crime itself. It's obviously designed for her protection. And although she solicits the intercourse, she cannot be held for soliciting because, again, for the same reason, she's the one that's protected by the criminal law. And this is standard law. I don't believe this makes any change at all either.
I have a question. George, in 1 sub B, talk about not a defense where the person with whom he conspires is irresponsible or has an immunity in prosecution. Now, you notice me this clear, I guess, this applies to the minor. Someone under the age of 14 or whatever it is,
or an idiot,
incompetent. Yeah, irresponsible, take care of that. I simply wonder, is the word immunity, does it, is it proper when we have referred, I think, to immaturity in the section dealing with minors? It's kind of nitpicking, I suppose, as long as you make it clear in the commentary, what are you doing, what happens in this?
We're trying to cover a situation, as you can mention in the notes, one who has the immunity statute applied to him, and he goes and testifies. He was immune from prosecution whether he testified before the grand jury. Now, because he was immune from prosecution, there's not allowed a co-conspirator to say, well, you can't prosecute him for the conspiracy, therefore, you only got one guy left, me, and you can't prosecute me.
That means he's going to be 13 years
of age. No, or he's going to be 10 years. Motion is to approve section bill submitted to the say aye.
Aye.
Let it know. Okay, we've got two more sections, 33 and then at the back.
Crime rather than
attempt. It's like when you've gotten charged with attempted rape because the girl said there was